From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A political convention is a party's chance to present its most winning self, to proudly declare under the eyes of the nation that this is who we are, this is what we stand for, and this is who we stand with. Of the particulars, the speakers in Cleveland this week left no doubt. America has a huge problem. It's a disaster. Sad, with a capital S.
You know, we have stagnating wages, we have skyrocketing health care costs, doubling of the debt, the threat of ISIS, the rise of China.
We learned the killer was an illegal alien gangbanger from Mexico.
We must not be afraid to define our enemy. It is Islamic extremist terrorism.
And for a nation that has lost its footing, its identity, its very soul, there is but one cure. And here probably is where the RNC most departed from form, because that cure did not include the requisite appeals to unity or even faith. No, the party that for 50 years has called for limiting the role of the federal government now says that the republic's fate rests on the federal government and specifically one singular pair of hands.
I will restore law and order to our country. Nobody knows the system better than me. I alone can fix it. I am your voice.
Doom and gloom is the alpha and omega of political campaigns. We're used to that. And we're used to politicians using exaggeration, fabrication, misdirection, and downright deception to paint America as the stagnant hellscape they intend to resurrect. But the passion with which they wielded those whoppers and the sheer number of them, isn't this, yeah, I'll use the word, new? We asked historian Rick Perlstein.
I don't think so, actually. If you think about the 2012 convention, which was based on, you know, the idea that Barack Obama said that people who were entrepreneurs did not deserve credit for their business accomplishments, that was a lie, too. The 2004 convention, when George Bush tried to run on his accomplishments in Iraq, which obviously were based on falsehoods. You know, don't forget Zell Miller in 2004 challenging Chris Matthews to a duel after Chris Matthews challenged the factualness of his claims in his speech that John Kerry wanted to defend the United States with spitballs.
Get out of my face. If you're going to ask me a question, step back and let me answer. You know, I wish we lived in the day where you could challenge a person to a duel.
So I think it's more of a continuation. I think it's definitely true that the shamelessness has been kind of ratcheted up cycle by cycle. But we can't lay all this at Donald Trump's feet.
One of the big questions going into the convention was because of police violence against citizens and violence against police, whether there was going to be, you know, some sort of civil disturbance or even riot reminiscent of 1968. You didn't even want to talk about that. Why?
I've been frustrated. You know, I understand it's kind of human nature to want to assimilate the unfamiliar into the familiar. But, you know, this isn't 68. This isn't 64. This is not 1980. I mean, history is a roiling ocean. You know, the waves crash in different directions. I think that a lot of the use of history this year has tended to kind of flatten out our understanding of what's going on with Donald Trump and not enhancing it.
Ah, the consolations of history. And yet, not so much. Because even though we didn't think we had much to add to this week's potent brew of rage and glee and lamentation, we still wanted to take note of one thing, something that began Trump's lengthy acceptance speech.
But here, at our convention, there will be no lies. We will honor the American people with the truth and nothing else.
But when the FBI disputed Trump's crime statistics, his staffer, Paul Manafort, said that since the agency had cleared Hillary Clinton of charges regarding her emails, the FBI need no longer be believed. When it comes to facts, Trump is like the Sphinx, impenetrable, immutable, complete unto himself. Nestle inside my cozy apocalypse, he says. Pay no heed to newspapers, academics, agencies, or opponents. Listen only only to me, or you will be humiliated, hungry, dead, or speaking Farsi. Truly the most cynical formulation we've ever heard.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the wake of the murders of police officers in Baton Rouge and Dallas, the Black Lives Matter movement has been on the receiving end of blame. Here's a recent sampling. Donald Trump, in the midst of day one of the RNC, speaking with Bill O'Reilly on Fox.
When you're calling death to police and to kill the police, essentially, which is what they said, that's a real big problem.
And Rush Limbaugh.
They're a terrorist group. They're quickly becoming a terrorist group committing hate crimes.
In fact, earlier this week, the White House rejected a petition signed by more than 141,000 people urging the White House to formally recognize Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group. Patrice Cullors is a co-founder and a leading voice in the Black Lives Matter movement. Patrice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So Trump and Limbaugh's indictment is predictable, but what do you make of Milwaukee's Black County Sheriff David Clark, who helped kick off the RNC this way?
I would like to make something very clear. Blue lives matter in America.
He delivered that the day after he said this on CNN after the deaths of the Baton Rouge police officers.
This anti-cop sentiment from this hateful ideology called Black Lives Matter has fueled this rage against the American police officer.
Our movement has never called for the execution of law enforcement, never. Yet many want to place the blame at our feet. There is a historical legacy of undermining Black communities who stand up and fight for our right to really be a part of this American democracy.
So tell me what Black Lives Matter does advocate.
We have a vision where ultimately law enforcement agencies will be the least prioritized for community safety. And in fact, we think community safety really looks like people's ability to have employment, our community's ability to have access to healthy food, shelter. What we've seen in the last two decades is monies being poured into law enforcement agencies, and those agencies have continued to violate the civil and human rights of Black people.
Statements that condemn Black Lives Matter often are followed by, why aren't you focusing more on Black-on-Black crime? Here's Rudy Giuliani on CBS earlier this month.
A Black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another Black, which happens every 14 hours in Chicago. And we never hear from Black Lives Matter.
This conversation of Black-on-Black crime is a distraction from the larger conversation around how the state has allowed for our communities to be completely decimated. Let's take here in Los Angeles. 52% of the city budget goes towards law enforcement. Yet our communities in LA have the highest unemployment rates, the highest homeless population. We are suffering from mental health issues, from drug addiction, and yet we see resources being pulled from our communities. And so when critics start to uplift this fallacy of Black-on-Black crime, it's them unwilling to take a hard look at how they've contributed to the devastation in our communities.
You've been explicitly advocating for police reform, including proposals, if I have it right, like defunding the police.
Correct.
Well, that's interpreted by critics as anti-police. And from there, they move to the charge that you're pro-violence against police. Obviously, that's a huge and dangerous leap.
Yes.
Is Black Lives Matter, in a sense, anti-police?
We are against the system of policing that has disenfranchised Black lives. If you go into any poor community, you will see a community that is heavily policed. You will see many Black people who are largely unemployed and trying to figure out how they're going to survive and feed their children. And in that poor community, you will see Black people not being able to get to school because their schools are actually funneling them to prisons.
Essentially, there are police in the schools. They get kids for minor infractions. And so it becomes a kind of corridor into the criminal justice system.
Precisely. Our call for defunding law enforcement is a common sense conversation to us. Where is money going locally, statewide, and nationally? It's going towards the law enforcement apparatus, policing, jailing, incarceration, and the in-between.
Anything cutting the budgets, the way to begin the process of shifting money in a different direction?
Yes. Looking at where we then put more money. What we fail to remember is that the kind of law enforcement and policing and incarceration we see today did not exist 40, 50 years ago. This is policing on steroids. What we are asking for is our communities to have a fighting chance. We don't even have that.
A Washington Post ABC News poll recently found that a majority of Americans think race relations are getting worse. But there are also scholars of the 60s who say that the progress we've made is clear, and that, in fact, the outcry against events like the shootings of unarmed Black men is a sign of that progress. Right, in your view?
Well, Americans are often scared to be honest about social ills. And so when we start to speak honestly about them, as the protests continue, as the highways continue to shut down, instead of seeing these moments as moments to expose the realities of this country, I think people feel fearful. And so I think why scholars are saying, actually, this is an amazing moment is because they're looking back at history, how these types of moments actually change the course of countries and peoples. The fact that 4 years ago, Black people being killed by law enforcement was not an important conversation to have just shows you how far we've come. We are frontline news. It's terrible that it's Black death that's frontline news, but the exposure has allowed for a new vision for what Black life can actually look like. This is our moment to try to get it right so that in 30 years, my child can say, I'm living in a better world because of the work of Black Lives Matter.
One last thing, and I know you've heard this question before. It's about the phrase Black Lives Matter. It's a response to the unspoken understanding that in many instances, Black lives don't matter, at least as much as white lives. And yet it's a phrase that's been consistently and sometimes willfully misconstrued. Do you ever wish you'd come up with Black lives also matter instead?
No.
But I mean, so many people didn't get it.
And that's because we don't have honest conversations about race. I think what happened when President Obama was elected is people really believed that we had overcome. We don't have a strong understanding of institutional racism in this country. And so Black Lives Matter, the strength in that really presents a new set of conversations for the country to grapple with. And we're seeing it. I think that's special. I think this is a special time.
And you'd ruin it if you stuck in also.
At this point, yes.
At this point, absolutely. Patrice, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Patrice Cullors is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. If Gavin Long, the shooter in Baton Rouge, had survived, he would have been prosecuted under Louisiana's brand new Blue Lives Matter Act, which classifies the killing of police officers as a hate crime. Florida, Wisconsin, and Kentucky have introduced similar bills, and a Blue Lives Matter Act has been presented to Congress. Are the police under attack? Here's Trump on Thursday.
The number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by almost 50% compared to this point last year.
In fact, the number of police killed by gunfire last year was down 14% from 2014, and the average number of total deaths has steadily declined since the Reagan era. Eugene O'Donnell is a former NYPD officer and prosecutor and currently a faculty member of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He says Pitching black lives against blue ones does nothing to address what really ails our police force.
What we have here, which is a crisis, unreported, is in large cities, 80% of violent crime is not solved. The police now, presented with homicide cases, are giving black people, in the main, some Latino people, condolences. I find that unacceptable. Now, I could tell you forever how bad jail is, prison is, but we need something to incapacitate people that are a danger to the community. And if you walk in the city of Chicago, street by street, the south side, the west side, this is what the people in the neighborhood actually want. The one thing the country absolutely does not need is a rerunning of law and order versus the new paradigm, which is the system is racist. Let's hit the shutdown button. The common thread is that poor people lose in both of those conversations and have lost now for 30 years. It's not a national crisis. The Republicans are talking junk, of course. The country is more safe by and large than it has been. But in inner cities, we got real serious issues. And they're not just people shooting. How many African-American middle-class people left Chicago in the south side, the west side, in large part because of public safety, because their needs were being ignored? Now, we have in Chicago now a police department in name only. They get there when they get there. And if you hear the cops talk, they say, be fetal, stay fetal. Don't do anything at all, which is cruel because in the African-American community, this has been a dual complaint. The cops are either brutal or feckless. There's no in-between. And that's where the conversation needs to be.
I know you're skeptical of the idea of community policing. Do you see that as a solution of any kind, or do you see any solutions? Where do we begin?
Well, I hate to say this, but we have a failed political system and a soon-to-be failed police system. It's hard to get people to vote. It's hard to get people engaged. Doubly hard for poor people that are just struggling to make ends meet. So when you talk about community policing, you're going to have big cities where community policing is good for the cops because they don't have to do patrol. It's most often used in the aftermath of a crisis. You know, I hate to be dismissive because certainly with an Eric Garner case on Staten Island, that to me was a case for community policing. I mean, you don't need to dedicate the whole agency to this. If you could have in each neighborhood a couple of cops well-known in the neighborhood who can use their soft power to go out and to try to negotiate people off the corners that are causing problems that are of concern. But this, again, is the rub with the police. The police have, in part, a conflictive adversarial role. So everybody likes community policing because it implies that policing is never conflictive or adversarial. And the fact is, there are people that bully whole neighborhoods, people that show utter disregard for whole neighborhoods, and you get repeated complaints. And we have an elite of people living in doorman condominiums saying, that's okay for them, but it wouldn't be okay for us. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of issues you have to navigate. But the problem is, in a lot of the communities, you'll see a neighborhood of 130,000 people and five of the same faces there. The idea that you're going to get a large cadre of people that are going to be so invested, especially now. If you go back years ago in the 70s, I think, well, the neighborhood police team in Harlem, which was very effective, but there was more engagement. You had the churches. You had a lot of people that you could connect into. Still have some of that, but let's face it, our democracy is in danger here. And people offering no solutions get center stage. Almost predictably, when you try to get at the solutions, the conversation ends with the press, because the pyrotechnics is what's exciting. And there are no magic solutions, but there are some solutions.
Tell me what you think some of them might be.
Well, I mean, the president's commission last year, and it should have been big news, didn't even try to suggest what the Kerner Commission said 50 years ago, which is every cop should have a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. They would be laughed out if they did that now. 99% of the nation's police departments do not have a four-year requirement. Cities that had a modest go to college for some credits requirement have been forced to drop that requirement as the recruiting pools shrink and shrink and shrink. Just getting ambulatory people to do the job is a challenge. And again, the elite thinks it's not a skilled job. It's an incredibly skilled job. And renowned media outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, this is a topic they don't spend any time on because it is really is an elitist outlook. Some knucklehead will be desperate enough, they'll take the job, and we can write 475 editorials criticizing those people.
I wonder then, do you agree with what the Dallas police chief said?
Not enough mental health funding. Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding. Let's give it to the cops. Here in Dallas, we got a loose dog problem. Let's have the cops chase loose dogs. You know, schools fail. Give it to the cops. 70% of the African-American community is being raised by single women. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. That's too much to ask.
The police become the representative of the government of first contact and last resort.
Is there any doubt that the political system has failed, that they're in absentia on the ground where they're most needed? Is there anything more depressing? This is a human issue. It's an American issue. We got kids, you know, in Chicago that fought for the country. They're veterans. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, can't we find some urgency?
So what you're saying is we need to allocate more resources for these communities, more opportunities for people to build their lives.
You know, in the 10 cities in the country that are most heavily affected with this, how do we take off our partisan hats and come up with solutions, job training, you know, improvement in the schools? I mean, the picture is bleak. And the decline in the labor movement, the decline in middle-class jobs, the postal service, public transit. I mean, there were so many places where people, white and black, had access to employment. They were homeowners. They were able to pay the bills. They were able to retire someday. This is not lost on the younger generation. They know there's no plan for them at all, not even a pretense, neither party. You know, we're talking about the inner city, but increasingly it's well documented here. This is a white and black issue also. And real reform, I think, has to be premised on the notion the police role is going to be shrunk. It's going to have to be shrunk just because of the numbers, but it also has to be shrunk because we're overtasking the police, over-asking the police. And something like deadly force, it's really hard to simultaneously send the cops into harm's way and micromanage their interactions. It's just a very hard fix. And this is where Black Lives Matter. I get Black Lives Matter because as a prosecutor, I investigated police shootings, and it was always a concern. We want to make sure that the police are only shooting when there's no other choice. And there are definitely shootings that are legally justifiable, but are not necessary. That might sound bizarre, but under our system, because the police have so much power, they can shoot even though it's not absolutely necessary. So what does that tell you? Well, I understand the black community, if you look and all the victims seem to be black, that doesn't seem to equate to their lives mattering in the justice system.
Where you and Patrice seem to entirely agree is that the focus has to be on those neighborhoods, on those schools, on the housing, jobs that offer you a handhold into the middle class.
But that conversation is dead on arrival. The notion of a government job program, that the government has some responsibility, I don't see Mrs. Clinton doing that. That's off the table. Congress is not going to do that. And I don't think this has to be terribly expensive, but we have 8 or 10 cities. We should make it a laboratory. How do we find those programs that work the best and replicate them where they're most needed? And the other thing that just is so obvious here, the federal government has to have a role here. That's what's been missing. You cannot say to Camden, New Jersey, or even Philadelphia, you know, go fix this. There has to be federal money on the table. And again, the depressing thing is it's not seeable. And what's also further depressing, you know, I could say it because the Republicans are saying it at their convention. There's this apocalyptic 1968, the cities are going to burn rhetoric hanging right out there. And when you had that the last time, that scared people into acting. This was self-preservation. That I don't see now at all. You almost get the impression some people wouldn't mind a great unraveling.
Eugene, thank you very much.
Sure.
Eugene O'Donnell is a former NYPD officer and now on the faculty of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
One year ago, the Department of Defense released its Law of War Manual, a first-of-its-kind comprehensive guide to wartime protocols. It was a landmark document, but within its nearly 1,200 pages, one section stood out, at least to us, the one detailing the treatment of journalists in wartime. It suggested that field commanders could classify journalists as, quote, unprivileged belligerents and even treat them as spies. Last August, we spoke to the Defense Department's General Counsel, Charles A. Allen, about the language, and he assured us the changes would be made. In January, we checked back in with Allen and Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook, who assured us that changes would be coming very soon. And now, 6 months after that, we're joined once again by Allen and Cook, and they have news. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Great to be here, Bob.
The language that most raised eyebrows went like this. In general, journalists are civilians. However, journalists may be members of the armed forces, persons authorized to accompany the armed forces, or unprivileged belligerents, which is, at best, open-ended. How does the new section of the manual read?
Bob, this is Chuck. We started out with a whole basic reorganization of the section on journalists. The previous version did not talk about first principles right up front, and it really should have. So it starts out with the fundamental that journalists are civilians, period. They are to be protected as such. On the issue of unprivileged belligerent, it makes clear that simply engaging in journalist activities does not make a journalist a target as an unprivileged belligerent. It does, however, preserve the concept that an unprivileged belligerent, that is somebody who's, in the case of Al-Qaeda, for example, fighting against the United States, that person would not be precluded from being considered an enemy simply because he or she is working as a journalist.
In other words, if some enemy was operating under its own media arm, let's just say, that does not accord them the benefit of the doubt. If you're Al-Qaeda, you're Al-Qaeda, whether you've got a press card or not.
That's right.
And Bob, if I could, I would like to read in more detail exactly how this section begins, because I do think it sets a different tone. And as Chuck said, it begins, in general, journalists are civilians and are protected as such under the law of war. Journalists play a vital role in free societies and the rule of law and in providing information about armed conflict. Moreover, the proactive release of accurate information to domestic and international audiences has been viewed as consistent with the objectives of U.S. military operations. DOD operates under the policy that open and independent reporting is the principal means of coverage of U.S. military operations. The manual in this section originally was intended more than anything to preserve the rights of journalists and to identify journalistic activities in a time of war. And yet we're not sure that the manual originally did that. We think this new updated version makes clear the rights, the protections for journalists, as opposed to any suggestion of what might undermine somebody operating as a journalist.
What was troubling in particular about the original language was that a field commander who had a burr in his saddle over some member of the press could have, if depending on how he or she chose to read the manual, just treat an annoying gadfly reporter as a spy.
Bob, and I remember that exchange that we had back in August on that or a similar hypothetical. I made the point that there was nothing in the manual that would give comfort to a commander that was considering such an outrageous decision. I don't think you could even construct that hypothetical out of the current version of the manual, the new one.
There was one other particularly nettling piece of language, a sentence that said, to avoid being mistaken for spies, journalists should act openly and with the permission of relevant authorities, which seemed to suggest that we can exercise our First Amendment rights only with the permission of the military. That has vanished in the latest draft?
It has. Now you have the recognition that members of the press might very well be in contact with enemy personnel. And this is a quote, efforts should be made to distinguish between the activities of journalists and the activities of enemy forces so that journalists' activities, e.g. meetings or other contacts with enemy personnel for journalistic purposes, do not result in a mistaken conclusion that a journalist is part of enemy forces. And I hope you agree that that's a much better way to make that point, that we recognize that it's a job that they need to do with confidentiality, and that includes talking to a whole host of people.
Including potentially the enemy.
And in any case, we want to see them protected.
The whole tone towards journalism seems to have changed. In the language that you read, Peter, there was quite a shout-out to the First Amendment and its function. And there's also, just in the headings, some language that suggests this is not an us-against-them proposition. You've removed the headings journalists and spying and security precautions and journalists and replaced them with much more anodyne language, such as journalists reporting on military operations, which seems to be a lot more forgiving as to the role of the press.
And Bob, I would just say much more accurate as well, frankly. We've gone to school and we, I hope, have listened, and it's been gratifying to me and I think to my colleagues to learn more about the profession, to learn more about the interchange.
To be able to hear directly from reporters who have operated in war zones, who have operated embedded with U.S. troops, it was very helpful for the legal folks here to be able to hear hypotheticals, even real-world situations that reporters had gone through, to get a better understanding about why some of these words might be interpreted the wrong way. And I think it's a testimony to Chuck and his team that the finished product reflects so much of that input.
Gentlemen, I feel like we're practically a coffee clutch at this stage. We talk so often, but thank you very much once again for joining us.
Bob, thanks for having us, and thanks for your interest and your input on this issue.
Thank you very, very much, Bob. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. And the effort by the DOD.
Had you not really pressed early for this, even before Peter took office, I think that was a real catalyst to us. And we tribute you.
Coming up, a breaking news consumer's handbook, Cool Edition.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, in the wake of last week's attempted coup, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared a 3-month state of emergency and began purging his government and military of suspected coup plotters. Though he blames his political nemesis, Mohammed Fethullah Gulen, there's still no hard evidence tying Gulen to the putsch attempt in which more than 200 died on the night of July 15th. As military forces took over strategic assets with tanks and soldiers, and as fighter jets thundered above, the media were an early target. At 9 p.m., renegade soldiers stormed the state TV channel and forced a shocked-looking anchor to read a statement declaring martial law. Half an hour later, President Erdogan, using the FaceTime app on his iPhone, managed nonetheless to appear on CNN Turk and urge citizens to take to the streets. At midnight, coup forces raided CNN Turk and the neighboring offices of Hurriyet, Turkey's largest daily, which in recent months had itself been targeted by the Erdogan regime for coverage of a corruption scandal. There, using another phone app, one Hurriyet employee managed to broadcast the scene. Emre Kizilkaya, Hurriyet's digital news coordinator, was at home in Istanbul when he literally felt the trouble begin.
There were so many F-16s now flying over Istanbul. Our building was shaking because of their sonic booms. When I arrived at work, it was already clear that there was some kind of mutiny inside the army. So we started to follow the news coming out of Ankara, the Turkish capital. It was like 11, Prime Minister Yildirim spoke to the media and said for the first time that it was a coup attempt.
All right, so it becomes clear that there's a coup taking place, and you're the biggest newspaper, and you've got to publish something online immediately. What was the first report out of Hurriyet?
The first report was about those low-flying jets and the soldiers taking over the Bosphorus Bridge in Istanbul, which connects two continents, Asia and Europe. One crucial decision for us was when, just around the midnight, the soldiers took over the Turkish public broadcaster, TRT, and forced one of the speakers to read out their declaration of the coup at gunpoint. And the Turkish public broadcaster acted as if it is a legitimate takeover. We chose the other way. Although we had been quite critical of the government, when the time comes to support democracy, we didn't really care about who is the president. We just said that this is democracy and it is under attack.
If this were 1970, let's say, and you were going to undertake an overthrow of an elected government, the first move in the playbook is to take over state TV. Except this is not 1970. I gather the coup plotters forgot what millennium we're living in.
We were puzzled by their actions because, for instance, people were on Facebook, Twitter, discussing all this stuff happening in the streets. We were making fun of them, Without controlling the free flow of information, they had no chance. We could see it.
You were making fun of them because they took over one TV station instead of, let's say, shutting down the internet service provider.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, they had fighter jets and tanks, and they were strafing the parliament building, and people were dying. So not so funny.
Yes. Plus, when you hear the voice of a soldier just in your building, it's also not funny.
So tell me about that. At one point in the wee hours of the morning, the troops of the takeover showed up both at CNN Turk, which is a neighboring building to Hurriyet's, and to your offices. What happened?
They actually landed their military helicopter full of 12 soldiers at first. There were two captains and 10 conscripts, privates. So they raided our office. They threatened the security guards. So those security guards opened our big iron door, which was reinforced just 9 months ago when pro-government protesters pelted our building with stones. It's ironical because at that time, pro-government people were attacking our building because of our critical stories at that time. And now soldiers who were against these pro-government people are raiding our building. They had machine guns and grenades. So it was a scary scene. And on the ground floor, we have an atrium, and all the floors have balconies seeing that atrium. So in the middle of it, the captain yelled, "Everybody's coming down."
Everybody marched downstairs at gunpoint. You marched upstairs.
Yeah, I made a critical decision. Actually, it could have cost my life. But I thought that people must see it somehow. We have a quite popular Facebook account. We have over 2.5 million likes. So I just push a button on my cell phone and started this Facebook Live session. It was like 4 a.m., I think, in order to hide myself. Plus, still being able to show the things just downstairs, I went to the fifth floor, which is the top floor, and from the balcony, I started to film what's happening below. Soldiers were rounding up our colleagues with guns, etc., and over 500,000 people watched that.
At what point did you surface?
I filmed for a few minutes, and then I noticed that my colleagues were walking in front of the soldiers at gunpoint, leaving the building. And I thought that hiding here would not be the smartest thing. So instead, I went downstairs, and the soldiers were so surprised when they saw me that I was coming from their behind. I just joined my friends there, and we left together.
I want to ask you one more thing, Emre. The coup, presumably, was a reaction to President Erdogan's consolidation of power. It was anti-democratic, but it was not responding to nothing. Hurriyet and you made the immediate decision to protect democracy and not to be a collaborator. But since then, Erdogan has used this opportunity to crack down still farther. There are reportedly 50,000 people who have been purged from various places in the bureaucracy and the infrastructure of education, and some media outlets connected with Erdogan's political opponents have been shut down. Is it not likely that you are actually going to wind up becoming the victim of the very regime that you put everything on the line to protect?
We are talking about Turkish F-16s bombing the Turkish parliament. So it was not only the government, but all parties, all political system, and all free speech. It was something against us all. Right now, it's too early to draw conclusions, I think. This is a time that we need to all be calm, I think. Of course, when you are looking from outside, a lot of things look so awful, like these numbers, etc. But at the same time, there are some glimmers of hope, too. Just now, in the past hour, the Istanbul municipality, which is controlled by the ruling party, announced that they will be providing free transport for the democracy rally of the main opposition party, CHP. There can be some reconciliation, and the government can use it, actually, as an opportunity to build a better democracy, but this is a choice. If they will choose not democracy, but tyranny, Of course we will be criticizing it. We were not intimidated by guns, and we will not be intimidated by threats of any kind.
Emre, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Emre Kızılkaya is digital news coordinator of Turkey's largest daily newspaper, Hürriyet.
During the chaos of coup reporting, some listeners told us on Twitter that they'd appreciate an on-the-media breaking news consumer's handbook, Coup Edition. Happy to oblige. But the truth is, we just don't see coups that much anymore. Researchers Clayton Tyne and Jonathan Powell looked into this and found that while in the 60s there were roughly 12 coup attempts around the globe per year, now there are 3, if that. Interestingly, they also found that plotters today are generally more successful than in the past. For instance, much of the Arab Spring, despite the optics, involved military coups in tandem with popular uprisings. Many of these coups were messy, but they succeeded in bringing down the government anyway. That didn't happen in Turkey. Nanihal Singh is the author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups. He says what happened in Turkey was a textbook fail.
The most important thing is that a coup has to appear to be inevitable. The way you do that is by seizing control over the major TV stations and radio stations. You shut down the ones you're not using so that you can control the narrative.
We begin in Thailand, a country where the constitution has been suspended. TV and radio stations are only permitted to broadcast military announcements.
The military has cut off at least 3 pro-Morsi satellite television stations. Al Jazeera says security forces raided its Egyptian television channel and detained some of its staff.
Government soldiers claim to have staged a coup in the West African country of Mali. The rebel troops now control the state-run broadcaster. The soldiers issued a statement. They said they had taken control of the presidential palace.
You make a broadcast which says we've already succeeded.
Okay, we talk a lot about bad reporting and breaking news situations. We talk about the fog of natural disaster and, of course, the fog of war. Tell me about the fog of coup.
If you mount a coup, the very first thing you have to do is make it clear that the government isn't in charge, or at least create a good deal of uncertainty about who is. Then the next thing you do is you fill that vacuum of power by making it clear that you are the person who's in charge. When journalists rush to judgment, oftentimes they're being manipulated by one party or the other.
The military tries to overthrow Burundi's president while he's out of the country. Thousands take to the streets to celebrate.
The leader of Burundi's failed coup is reportedly arrested. The president is said to be back in the country.
Very often reporters will talk about the military. But actually what's happening during a coup is you're having a struggle for power within the military. It's one faction against the other. And so talking about the military is actually part of the spin. When they claim that they're in control, it's usually premature. The purpose of it is to create self-fulfilling expectations, because all of the key leaders of military units will believe that the junta is in charge. They will then throw their support their way, and they will try to suppress opposition to it. In so doing, they will then become in charge. In the old days, governments had monopoly over broadcasting. And in that case, it was easy. You'd go to the capital and you take over the main broadcasting facility. These days, it's more complicated. You have satellite TV, you've got cable. What Erdogan did was he got on CNN Turk, which they had failed to shut down. They shut it down afterward.
So you've got your broadcast station.
Mm-hmm.
Step 2 is your statement. What do you say? And here, you could tell right away that the Turkish coup was on really shaky ground.
What I thought they did wrong was that they had the newscaster read the statement.
Sevgili seyirciler, bu metnin tüm Türkiye Cumhuriyeti kanallarında
yayınlanması. And that lacked credibility.
And it was an anonymous statement.
Yeah, you didn't actually know who was at the heart of the coup. As a matter of fact, to this point, we're still not entirely sure. But if they'd stepped up themselves, that might have generated more confidence.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a general and you put your face out there and you say, I'm taking charge, people will believe that he's only going to do that if he actually believes he can succeed.
So, to assess a coup's chances, look for faces and names. It shows confidence in the effort.
And if you're trying to defeat the coup, it has to go the other way. A great example of this is in Spain in 1981. The king of Spain, Juan Carlos, got on TV and he broadcast a statement where he was opposing the coup. And he did so in his military uniform with all his medals.
Al dirigirme a todos los españoles,
It was with that broadcast that he defeated the coup.
Now, at first it seemed like Erdogan had lost the narrative game. There were Twitter rumors that he was in a plane circling over Germany, asking for asylum on the run, while the plotters shut down the airport. What are the decisive locations if we as news consumers want to try and forecast the success of a coup attempt?
The main symbolic targets. The parliament building doesn't have any tactical relevance. What it does have is symbolic relevance, the same way you take down one side's flag and you put up another. Bridges and airports, the airport is what connects a country to the outside. You're showing, no, you're the person who's in charge.
There are a lot of people who suggest that social media can disrupt the usual patterns. What do you think about social media as something that can change the course of a coup?
I think the jury's still out. The more social media approaches what broadcast media can do, reach a very large number of people in a short period of time and create common knowledge.
The public square.
Exactly. That's what's critical. Twitter is very good for spreading information, but it spreads it privately.
Now let's talk about the visuals.
Mm-hmm.
Cast your mind back a week ago Friday. All these images of chaos and confrontations between police and protesters. When you see violence on the streets during a coup attempt, what should you make of that?
The stronger the coup makers, the more bloodless, quick, orderly, and almost silent a coup is. The more violence you have, the weaker the hand they have to play, the more they have to use force to compensate.
And you know this particularly in the case of Turkey, right? Its previous coups.
The previous coups were all either bloodless or the 1961 had 3 deaths, I believe.
Hmm.
And this was definitely bloody. In Ankara, for example, the Air Force was attacking targets.
As unpopular as Erdogan is in many circles, even those who condemn his repressive policies opposed the coup because they saw it as worse. It was a case of what they saw as the lesser of two evils. You have an authoritarian figure, and you have the prospect of his undemocratic ouster. Do you see that a lot?
Deciding which side to back during a coup is always very tricky. And yes, sometimes you have people who believe in democracy, and if they believe the current government has authoritarian tendencies, it becomes a very difficult choice for them. Sometimes it goes the other way. So when General Musharraf took power in Pakistan, he was generally greeted with support by liberals who thought that he was saving them from an Islamist-elected government. Now, they changed their mind very quickly. What would be interesting is seeing what people in Turkey feel today. However, now it's becoming increasingly difficult for people to speak their mind in Turkey.
So as we watch the coverage, we should repress the urge to cheerlead, especially when a coup aims to topple an authoritarian strongman. That's what we're likely to do.
But the question is, what comes next? When you look at the Arab Spring countries, only Tunisia is a stable democracy now. I remember how much optimism and hope we had when Mubarak was forced to resign.
That brings me to the very last question. And it isn't so much about how the coup is covered, but how it isn't. Because as we've often seen, the news crews and generally the world's focus tend to wander off after the shooting stops.
Yep. The news cycle on Turkey has been very short. When the coup happened, a number of media outlets reached out to me for commentary. And unfortunately, I was flying back into the country on Saturday morning. And I found that by Saturday night, media attention had shifted to the RNC almost entirely. And this has me concerned because there's some very important developments in terms of what's happening in Turkey today. And I would hope that the media would be able to spare some of their bandwidth for what's continuing to go on.
So then you would offer as your last point for this breaking news consumer's handbook on coups, don't look away.
Most definitely. The same way that the news media gets used during coups to create a narrative, afterwards, when we shift our attention away, there's still things that are going on. Our narrative should not be the coup is over, there's nothing of interest that's going on anymore. If we cared about Turkey 2 days ago, we should care about them today as well.
Nanihal, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Nanihal Singh is the author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups, and a professor of political science at the Air War College. You can find our breaking news consumer handbook, Military Coup Edition, at our website on themedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. We had more help from Micah Loewinger, Emma Stelter, and Isabel Christo, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.